This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Bills banning fracking and fracking-like activities have once again been proposed in the Florida House and Senate. They're basically the exact same bills that were shot down last year by House Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez. Later this hour, we'll talk with a researcher from Cornell University who's an expert on unconventional oil and gas extraction. He's coming to town later this week to update local media on the current state of fracking research. We'll also chat with someone from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida to get the latest on efforts to bring fracking to the Sunshine State. But first, the Sunshine State survey shows Floridians are concerned about the opioid epidemic, race relations, and the treatment of undocumented immigrants. Most of them also think that raising the age of teens can getting a boating license is a good idea. That's just a sampling of the issues that Floridians responded to in this year's annual Sunshine State survey, which is conducted in collaboration between the University of Southern Florida and the Nielsen Data Measurement Company. The project's part of the School of Public Affairs, and it's under the direction of distinguished professor Dr. Susan McManus, who joins us now to talk a little about the methodology behind the survey and the results this year. Dr. McManus, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about the annual Sunshine State survey. Did you participate this year? Do you have a particularly strong feeling about any of the subjects that they covered in that survey? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, Dr. McManus, take me to the beginning, which wasn't all that long ago. The survey started back in 2014. What brought the project on?
Well, actually, it began before then. It's just that it was done by Leadership Florida, and USF Nielsen took it over. USF took it, and then, of course, Nielsen volunteered in 2014. But it's the longest-running public policy survey in the state. It's really important to business and community and elected officials to be able to see trends in public opinion and to get a broad brush of how Floridians are thinking. It's not a horse race poll, meaning we don't ask, you know, are you a Democrat or Republican, or who are you for governor? This is straight out an issue-based survey, and it's really been a joy to work on it for years. And my classes at USF help contribute timely questions regarding pressing issues to the survey each year.
How are the students involved?
They take a class in media and politics. It's a senior-level class. It's a combination of people with mass communication and political science majors, two fields of study that really rely heavily upon public opinion research, cover it or do it and study it. And we work very carefully with them, learning about statistical sampling, but also learning about question wording and question orders. And the professionals from the Nielsen Company come into the class and work with the students on all of the things that we just discussed, but particularly about question wording and question order. And then the class at the end of the semester comes up with the questions that we'll ask in the summer. But they also get to go to the Nielsen Company's headquarters and see the professionals who are actually doing the calling on their questions at work.
So is the survey administered by phone?
Yes, it is. It's done by Nielsen professionals. And one of the reasons is that Florida is a very complex population to survey for novices. For example, we have tremendous differences in languages in our state, particularly in Southeast Florida, but also the age differentials require different skills for being able to ask questions. For that reason, we are elated that Nielsen contributes their time and professional expertise to actually doing the calling.
Yeah, well, they're the pros. You know, they're the ones that have been doing it for quite some time and in a lot of different venues and different applications, for sure.
Right.
And then also that data that's involved in the back end. I mean, it's not just writing the questions and asking them, but then crunching those numbers. And are the students involved in any of that or just watching the process?
They are involved in that. We handpick really top-level performers in the class. We have four students who work on the data analysis and two students who work on the infographics, which is one of the wonderful things that our survey does is we distribute through social media the results in very eye-catching and informative infographics, which is one of the trends that we're seeing now. And polling is to actually, you know, turn your data into pictures that grab people's attention via social media. So, yes, we have our students involved in the analysis. I oversee that. I do a lot of that myself, working with them, and they help analyze it and try to figure out the whys of the trends that they're looking at. It's really very rewarding. It's one of the most interesting and wonderful things I do as a professor.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that the students are so involved in it, not just accumulating the information, crunching the numbers, but then also then communicating the results of that has got to be key. And it's almost as important as how the individual questions are worded.
Well, absolutely, because increasingly people won't read a lot of text, but they will visually look at something. And we know from medical research that many, many people are visual learners as opposed to actually reading things. And more people describe themselves as visual learners. And you certainly see that among the younger generations.
Yeah. So how many people are surveyed for this every year?
Over 1,200, which makes it a very large sample and very important, because if you look at what national polling firms, public policy-focused firms like Gallup and Pew Research Center use similar size surveys. And it's important in Florida because if you want to break down results by race and ethnicity and region and income, and particularly race and ethnicity, you have to have a large enough sample that when you break it into pieces, the pieces are statistically valid. And the margin of error for this poll is plus or minus 2.3%. And one of the things I always teach people is when you see a poll, look at what the margin of error is, because if it's over 5%, that means there's really a 10% swing. You can only be confident in a 10% range. So the size of this sample and the margin of error and the representativeness of it, we make sure that the sample is representative on the basis of race and ethnicity and gender and age and also region of the state.
Do you feel like it's important to communicate not only the results of the study, but also the type of analysis that's being done and the number of people that are being asked these questions? Because it seems like in this era, there's a lot of skepticism and people don't really want to believe polls and they think that they've been done shoddily. Do you feel like it's become more important recently to put forward a case that this is a very well-vetted survey?
Absolutely. And if you can't look at a survey and see the sample size and who's paying for the survey, who's doing it, that kind of thing, then you really should be a bit skeptical. And, of course, the polls were pretty off in the 2016 race. Not that this is a political survey, but the fact that they were wrong has also shaken people's confidence in polls. But we do know from analysis that's been done by groups that study polling that these kinds of surveys, where it's a policy survey and it's adults 18 and over and you don't ask people anything political and you tell them that their responses are anonymous, that you do get a lot more cooperation and the results are a bit more solid and credible than straight-out political polls.
Well, it seems like a yay or nay, a 50-50 on the political poll. Are you voting for this guy or that guy or woman? And then the difference being the way that the things are phrased on this particular survey, I mean, it's almost a paragraph to get to the point of what you're answering.
It is, and that's why you have to also be careful to use language that's very understandable by people. The students struggle with that sometimes. They want to get a little bit more wordy than they should, and professionals tell you that you should really aim most of your wording around anywhere from 8th grade to 12th grade, but no more than that, and aiming more towards the lesser end of it, not because of educational level, but because people, if you use a lot of wordiness, you lose them by the time you get to the question you really want them to answer.
Yeah, you get to the end of the sentence and they're stuck on a word from before that they hadn't quite heard.
Right, and they say, can you repeat it again? So it's not very efficient either.
Yeah, and then it ends up taking more of their time and they might get more resentful of the survey even happening. So,
right, exactly.
How have these questions evolved over the past several years? I mean, have they gotten, the subject matter, has it changed or wording? I mean, how have things changed over time?
Well, one of the things is that we have repeat questions, a certain portion of this survey, and there's around 85 questions on it. It's a substantial survey. Mm-hmm. So a certain portion of the questions stay the same. For example, you know, are things getting better or worse or about the same where you live, you know, to get a feel for people? How's your, you know, Is your household feeling more or less financial stress than 5 years ago or something like that? But we have trend line data on things like how much do you trust your state and local officials to do what's right for the people? How well do you think the state is performing in terms of education, teaching people proper skills?
Yeah, these are the questions that kind of...
What's the most important issue facing the state? That's usually, you know, that's a very important, consistent question because the results change over time.
But the question's always evergreen.
We have brand new questions that are timely. For example, in this year's, you know, poll, which one of the ones we just released today was asking people whether the state should, you know, actually put more money into protecting religious facilities and schools against hate group attacks. Well, you know, we didn't ask that question 5 years ago, but it's very timely now. And very interesting because two-thirds of Floridians who answered the survey said, yes, by all means, that the state should protect religious facilities and schools from hate group attacks. So the key for my students every year is coming up with around 20 new questions that are timely that will be important when the legislature gathers in the next early next year, but also very, very important to advocacy groups at the community level and also to business people. For example, we have a survey coming out in a couple of weeks that asks people why they would choose to live somewhere or not. Well, that's very useful to community leaders and business leaders as well as elected officials.
We are talking about the Sunshine State Survey with Dr. Susan McManus, the director of the project. You can join the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And now, Dr. McManus, you mentioned briefly the question indicating a willingness for the state to financially help religious organizations in defending against hate groups. That's one of those more timely questions. Overall, what did the respondents have to say about concerns regarding hate groups?
Well, 66%, first of all, said that they did feel that the state should help fund or, you know, protect people by providing funding. Interestingly, when you look at who was most strongly in favor of that policy approach by the state, it was women and African Americans, both at 71%, considerably higher. And if you look at public opinion, you know that historically women have been more concerned about violence than men. And African Americans certainly more concerned about violence. In fact, in many of the violent attacks against religious facilities have been black churches in some parts of the South. So one of the challenges to the students is not only to look at the data, but then also to look at who is supportive or who's less supportive and try to explain why or look back at other research, what makes a certain kind of demographic have certain opinions. So students learn a lot about public policy formation and demographics and the intersection of particularly gender and race and age.
Yeah, I wondered about age and education level. How do those factor in on questions, you know, such as this? There are other questions regarding immigration that came out today, too.
Well, somewhat. For example, younger people are a little less critical of the state about immigration and so forth because they're in the mix right now. A younger person is in a much more diverse population mix. That's who they interface more than older people. And certainly when it comes to protecting safe spaces on schools, the public is a little bit more mixed, but younger people are much more in favor of providing safe spaces for students at universities. And so that would be an example of where generational differences exist.
Mm-hmm. And I was noticing that overall Floridians say that they're 67% in favor of requiring employers to verify immigration status upon hiring people. Is that something supported across the whole state, or is that more in traditionally conservative areas like here in Southwest Florida?
Checking of credentials and so forth by employers is much more broad brush because when you think about it, a lot of people are concerned that immigrants are taking jobs away from others. For example, the ones who are more concerned about that are North Florida people, which would be the more conservative, but also areas like Orlando and Naples. There are two other areas where people want to have people check immigrant status of new hires more carefully. And sometimes it's where job competition is the heaviest. Older Floridians are much more, baby boomers are much more in favor of that as well. Again, people in the workforce, older people in the workforce are a little bit more threatened by the immigrants taking their jobs, particularly those who might have been laid off during the last recession and have never gotten back to their current, to their then earning status.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found kind of striking was the rating of the state's efforts to improve race relations, and that came out today. Can you explain that a little bit to me?
The question was, just one second here, that 67% say that the state just does a fair or a poor job in improving race relations. And this is interesting because, as you know, Florida's minority population more closely mirrors the country at large than any other state. And the most critical of the current status of the state's handling of race relations comes from, not surprisingly, African Americans. It comes from people living in South Florida, the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Palm Beach areas. And why is that? Because they have a larger share of minority residents there. And also, it comes a lot from Naples, and that area has a larger share of older white college graduates. And education does make a difference in how you view race relations, so it's not surprising that college graduates are more critical of the state's failure to improve race relations than someone who hasn't really studied race issues very thoroughly to the degree that a college graduate would have.
It's kind of an interesting difference between the two groups who both most overwhelmingly responded with the negative ratings for the state as far as race relations.
Right, right.
That's it.
And younger ones are less critical because obviously they don't see as much differential racially as others.
Yeah, it's just,
so they're more likely to say that the state's doing a pretty good job in that area.
Yeah, but I find it, were you surprised by that, to see that Miami and Palm Beach with larger minority populations and as well as Naples with a large share of older white college grads had the 71, 83, and 72% negative rating for the state when it comes to improving race relations? Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because I think a lot of minorities feel like that it hasn't been good, that they have been the objects of discrimination or so forth. And where are minority populations, particularly African-American populations, in terms of sheer numbers, are much higher in Southeast Florida. And you have the mix there of Afro-Caribbeans, African-Americans. You have, a wide country of origin differences in Hispanics that live in Southeast Florida. So I wasn't surprised at all. And I'm not surprised that college graduates, older college graduates, which there's a high percentage of those in Naples, are also more critical because they are more aware of racial disparities. From an educational perspective, you simply learn more about that subject matter than others.
Mm-hmm. So I want to change tracks here. Another part of the study or the survey looked at the heroin situation and the opioid epidemic. 72% of Floridians say that they think spending more money to reduce heroin and other opioid drug overdoses is a good idea. So were there any differences regionally or in any other of these different qualifying groupings when it came to responding to this?
No, there was no regional difference because this is such a serious problem. It touches every piece of Florida, and it's an issue that you have a tremendous amount of awareness in, because even the governor had declared the opioids to be a public health emergency a couple of months ago. And people who are really wanting the state to spend more money on addressing this issue are women, again, not surprising, whites, and actually whites are more into opioids than minorities, and also the more affluent households, 75,000 above, again, opioid, and, you know, a lot of the opioid misuse is in those kinds of households. This is different than, you know, some of the alcohol issues and whatever. Opioids, what has really elevated the issue is the fact that it is reaching into the higher income and, you know, Anglo populations, and much more so than previous drug problems have.
Yeah. So what would you say, based on this year's survey results, is the biggest concern for Floridians?
Well, number one on the most important issue is still the economy, even though it's less dominant than it has been and for some time. But what is really on the upswing is the environment, which is number two. And one of the things that's quite interesting about the environment, if you really drill down into that and you ask people, you know, what's Florida's top environmental problems, loss of natural lands for wildlife is at the top of the list, but other big issues are invasive species and water-related problems, rising sea levels, and even, you know, other kinds of pollution. But climate change is on the rise. But the interesting thing about the environment is something that we see all over this survey is generational differences. If you want to understand why the environment has become elevated as an issue, look no further than Florida's younger population. And across the country, the millennials are often being described as the environmental generation. And they were also, younger people, the most supportive of charging a new tax that would be earmarked for environmental protection efforts in Florida. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of generational differences between the younger millennials and the older boomers. And I think a lot of people may not realize that millennials are now America's largest generation, and they're a big part of Florida as well.
So what do you anticipate happening as a result of this survey in the way of maybe legislative action or business? What kind of things happen once people get this information?
A lot of advocacy groups or professionals in fields will look at it and use it, and use it particularly to see who has what kinds of opinions. One of the things that we like to focus on a lot is the fact that you have things where people just don't have enough information. And when you ask a question and you say, I don't know, what does that tell us? That tells us that, you know, these groups that are concerned about that issue really have an educational mission. One of the good examples was the move over law here, which we asked people whether, in fact, you know, how aware they thought Floridians were of the move over law, which over when you have an emergency vehicle or a trooper or whatever at the side of the road, you're supposed to move over or slow down. Well, a huge percentage did not know what that is. And you might say, well, how did that affect, you know, one of my students came up with that question because he had a friend whose dad had been hit as a trooper by somebody who had failed to move over. So sometimes the questions that come up are very personal with the students. And mm-hmm. that was a good one. But to your point, it says, if you were in the transportation business and you're concerned about traffic safety and the safety of emergency people on the highways, this information from this question would tell you, you know, we've got to do a lot more education of the population at large because they just don't know what this is. And, for example, in the past, we've seen several of our questions end up being used as part of the discussion in the legislature. A few years ago, we asked a question about should elementary children be required to have recess, and a high percentage of our respondents said yes, and that ultimately became law.
Yeah, it did, just last session.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes a couple sessions, but the fact that we're asking relevant questions that are very timely, when other places are just asking who's winning an election or who's ahead or what, you know, how do you feel about Democrats and Republicans, this is not that kind of survey. This is straight out policy, and it's the case that Florida was a little bit late coming to this. A lot of other big states have had public policy-focused polls for quite some time, so I was thrilled when Leadership Florida actually started this. Mm-hmm. In 2007, and we have been able to continue it at USF with the help of Nielsen.
It's just an interesting thing. I bet there are probably some people that think that they're on one side of the aisle when it comes to politics, but when they answer the actual question about a given topic, they might be qualified on a different side.
Exactly. And we have so many different kinds of questions. I urge your listeners, go to sunshinestatesurvey.org, and you can see we have released 7 different topics so far, and we have 3 more to go before we're done at the end of November. And it's a wide range of issues, everything from, I say, the environment to beach renourishment to, you know, taking care of vets to dealing with the mentally disabled to looking at how many people feel that elderly are being scammed by unscrupulous caregivers to gun laws to opioids to rehabilitation of criminals to how the LGBT community is treated and the whole issue of human sex trafficking, wind turbines, you name it. We have really taken great care to have a wide variety of relevant issues facing Floridians in this survey.
So when do you get to work on crafting the next survey?
It will start in January of this next year. The spring semester is when we develop the questions, and the calling happens in August when it's sort of a lull. It takes a couple months to really analyze it, and the rollouts usually begin in October.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank our guest, Dr. Susan McManus with the Sunshine State Survey and the University of South Florida. Thanks so much for taking the time to walk us through this.
Thank you. Remember, sunshinestatesurvey.org, listeners, tune in.
And go check out even more of the results. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, a fracking ban is once again on the legislative agenda in Tallahassee. We'll learn more about the proposal and the current state of research into hydraulic fracturing after this break.